So in the early 1990s, Kayla and I spent about 7 months living at the guest house at the Dalai Lama's monastery. I've mentioned this, I think, a number of times here, because for us it was a very transformative experience, as you can imagine it would be. And we were there on retreat. And when you're on retreat, one of the things that you like to do is get up and walk, because you spend so much time sitting. And in that situation, there were some temples that we could circumambulate, which is to say walk around. And that's a very traditional thing in Buddhism. And the monks would do that, and various visitors would do that. So I like to do that. So I would get up and I'd circumambulate the old main temple in the compound there. And at one point I noticed this old codger who was shuffling around doing the same thing, an old monk. He was kind of stooped and gnarly looking. And if you've seen paintings of the Chinese Lohans, for example, and they have this weird look to them, he had that kind of quality. And he was out there every day doing his thing. Didn't talk to anybody, just walking around in circles. And there are these prayer wheels on three sides of the monastery, and every time he walked past a prayer wheel, he'd spin it as he went. And I thought to myself, oh, he's kind of one of those old, uneducated types, you know. And so I did my thing. I'd do my mantras, and I'd walk around. And this went on for a while, like weeks. But I was always fascinated by this guy. And I got more and more interested in him, even though there was no particular reason to be getting interested in him. And I thought, I'm going to see if I can get him to smile at me. I mean, there are a lot of Westerners who pass through there, and the monks often will tend to be friendly, but not pay him a whole lot of attention in other ways. So eventually I got him to smile at me, and then every time because I walked faster than he did, you know, I'd go past him, and I'd smile at him, he'd smile at me, and, you know, that would go on, because for quite a while, maybe a half an hour, going around in circles. I passed them half a dozen, eight times or something like that. So finally, I'd gotten really curious about this guy for no particularly good reason that I could imagine. And I asked one of our monk friends about him, Sangye. Sangye said, oh, him. He's the Vajra master. I said, what's that? And he said, well, that's the most accomplished guy in the monastery. Oh. So then, okay, so the next time I'm out doing the circumambulation, I'm kind of looking at this guy. He doesn't have very many teeth, looks impoverished, looks like his feet are a size 9 and he's wearing size 14 shoes, actually house slippers, sort of shuffling along. So I smile at him, he smiled at me, and I thought, well, this is really interesting. So then I asked Sangye, is there any way that I could talk to him, you know, and would Sangye translate? And he said, well, I'll see. I mean, you know, he doesn't just talk to people, because he's a really busy guy. He's teaching us everything that we need to know, basically. He came back after a couple of days and said, yeah, the Vajra Master will see you. Okay. So I went to his room, and we had a conversation. It was interesting in a number of ways, but for the purposes of this conversation, as I was sort of parting, he said, remember that the essence of the Dharma, the most important thing in the Dharma, which is, say, the most important thing in Buddhism, is transforming negative minds into positive minds. And then he gave me an apple, and he said, this will be good omen for your practice. And I left. And then I noticed I was drenched with sweat, because I'd been constantly taking off coats and parkas and whatnot, even though we were in a concrete room that had no heat, and the weather was the middle of winter, so the temperature was probably about 10 degrees above zero inside and out. And I hadn't noticed that was going on. I thought, why am I so hot? What was going on? I never did figure that out, although that was interesting. But I thought about what he said, converting negative minds into positive minds. Now, the Tibetans say it that way. We would say converting negative states of mind into positive states of mind. Wouldn't we? But they don't. They say converting negative minds into positive minds. That's the literal translation of the Tibetan. And what that reveals to me, and I've thought about this quite a lot, what that reveals to me is that we have this idea that there's this underlying stable something, which is the mind, and that it can kind of go through changes, like taking on different colors or something. But there's a stable something underneath there, had different states of mind. Their understanding is, I think, different. Their understanding is you got one kind of a mind and then you got another kind of a mind. There's a continuity, but there's a disjunction, which is to say, they don't imagine there's a thing which stays the same over time except for slight changes. They understand there are many different things that arise over different periods of time. That's the way I interpret it anyhow. And what that leads me into thinking about is that, as the Buddhists say, the main problem that drives negative states of mind is ignorance. That doesn't mean stupidity. The Sanskrit word for it is avidya, and it's an active kind of misunderstanding the nature of what's going on. And the essence of that active misunderstanding is grasping after things to be independent and permanent, and to be not only independent and permanent in the sense of independent of their environment and unchanging, but independent of our ideas about them. That's what we think that these things are. And in fact, none of that stuff is true. As you know, if you really read very much Buddhist philosophy, and if you meditate deeply, you see it's not true. In fact, the reality is everything is constantly changing. Everything's made up of parts. Everything depends upon causes and conditions. Everything is what it appears to be because of our thoughts as much as anything else. And equally importantly, everything that acts has consequences. So thinking about this from an ecological point of view, basically, if you look at the situation that we're in as beings on this planet, what we've done is we've ignored the fact, conveniently, that everything depends upon everything else, and we've ignored the fact that our actions have consequences. So they can bury nuclear waste out at Hanford in metal containers in the ground and say, well, we've taken care of the problem. Right, in metal containers that will last for maybe 20 years or maybe even 40 years. And what's in them? Something that has a half-life of what? 100,000 years? But we're not going to worry about that because we won't be here. Right, and that's the way people think about things. They don't think about how all the pieces fit together, and they don't think about the consequences of their actions. So that's a certain kind of misknowledge or misunderstanding or ignorance that comes from this sort of deep way of miscognizing things. Well, from a certain point of view then, if things are going to improve, then, among other things, that kind of ignorance has to stop controlling our actions as individuals. And the other day, or the last time we met, I said, you know, fundamentally, the main issues will be changed systemically. Fundamentally, the main problems that we're dealing with will not be problems that each of us can change by our individual actions. And yet, we do feel impelled to make changes if we have some kind of ecological consciousness. I mean, in a trivial sense, I try to avoid using swizzle sticks in my coffee, and I talked about that. That's pretty minimal. And it can seem like, what can we possibly do? Well, I got tweeted an interesting quote today. We've gotten interested in using Twitter. I got tweeted an interesting quote today from the Dalai Lama, in which he says, well, you might think that as a small individual you can't do very much. And he says, but think about what happens when you try sleeping with a little mosquito. Teeny little mosquito, big you, but big effect. So there's some kind of hope, right? So if we can change our minds, there's some way that each of us individually can change something. You know, who knows what, but we can change our minds, we can change something. So then the question is, what is there in Buddhist practice that can convert negative minds into positive minds, most specifically from the point of view of developing what I would call an eco-awareness, an awareness of our impact on the environment, as we live, as we interact with those around us and whatnot. So when I reflect on that, the first thing I think about is I think about the time, again, that Kayla and I spent in a Zen monastery. We lived at San Francisco Zen Center for quite a period of time. And when I first started hanging out there, I thought of Zen as being like, you know, everybody sits still and it's like no rituals and it's very, you know, so simple and practical and whatnot. And what I noticed was that they'd made it a point at San Francisco Zen Center to maintain the traditions they'd inherited from Japan, the Soto Zen traditions. They were very, very, very focused on that. And they felt that that was their obligation to the future, to pass those traditions and those rituals on to the future. And I wasn't always entirely clear why. You know, my sense of Zen was a little bit more like beatnik Zen, you know, whatever that is. But it wasn't that Zen. But you know, I paid attention and I started learning. One of the things I noticed was every morning, the abbot and his assistant and a number of other monks wandered all over the property at Green Gulch, of which there's a lot of property, going from shrine to shrine, offering incense and bowing. Now, this is 4:30 in the morning all year round, so like they're taking this pretty seriously if they're up that 30 and it's that early, and it's really cold. They would go to every little shrine in the meditation hall, out on the property in the gardens where the flowers were, the little shrine in the kitchen, the little shrine in the dining room, all this stuff. So this is a big deal. And before every meditation session or every teaching, the same thing. And the monk would do full, the abbot would do full bows, or whoever was teaching would do full bows in front of the statue of Manjushri. And I thought, this is very interesting. This doesn't seem very Zen, but there it is. Why are they doing this? Well, they're doing this because they're understanding what I would call reciprocity, and they're practicing reciprocity. What they're understanding is their obligation and their relationship to the ancestors of the past, and their obligation and their relationship to those that come after them, for whom they will be the ancestors. And they're also understanding their relationship with everything else that's going on around them. And when they're offering incense, they're practicing a remembrance of that relationship to everything that's going on around them and their connectedness with everything that's going on around them in a very tangible, very mindful, very prescribed way every single day, day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out. Someone's doing it. If the abbot is sick, someone else takes his place. Day in and day out, it just goes on and on like that. And that's something worth remembering, because, in fact, that's the type of practice any of us can do. We can all get up in the morning, and we can offer water to the plants and say, I'm offering water to this one plant, but in doing so, I'm hoping that all life will thrive, that all plants will thrive. We can imagine this. I mean, the Dalai Lama talks about rejoicing in the good fortune of others. He talks about appreciating how a small thing can be representative of a large thing. And we can cultivate our minds in that way. Now, specifically the kind of practice that we do in the Vajrayana tradition that comes from India and was maintained in Tibet is a bit different than the Zen practice, but in some ways there's similarities, and there's some ways where that kind of reciprocity can be cultivated, and we can understand our relationship with the ancestors and understand the complexity of how everything depends on everything else and how everything is informed by everything else and how everything relates to everything else. In the Tibetan tradition, they've maintained a tradition that came out of India, which was offering 8 traditional offerings to a guest. And in the sadhanas that we practice, you hear them, argyam, padyam, Gande, Dupe, Pushpe, Aloke, Navidya, Shabda. These are foot washing water because the travelers would need to wash their feet. Mouth water because they'd be thirsty. Perfume because they maybe didn't smell all that great. Flowers, on and on and on. I won't go into detail what they are. But the point is, these are physical offerings that are made, but physical offerings that are made to who? They're physical offerings that are made to all of us, but they're also physical offerings that are made to the lineage of the lamas. And they're made to the Buddhas that we invite into our meditation. And when we're meditating, when we're doing the sadhana and meditating, we visualize creating these offerings and we visualize the offerings being given to the Buddhas, to the Bodhisattvas, and to the Lamas, the teachers that we're connected with. And we're experiencing, we're practicing reciprocity when we do that, because they're coming and giving their blessings to us. Their blessings are, they're reminding us that we and they are fundamentally not different, and that fundamentally their wisdom and their compassion is our wisdom and our compassion. And what we're giving them is something to say, you're giving us something and we're giving you something. We're closing the circle in reciprocity. Just as the native peoples, if they were hunting, would give something back when they took an animal, would give something back when they took something from the ground, would give something back when they took the roots. They always close the circle. We don't close the circle as moderns. We forget to close the circle. What happens when the circle is broken? You know what happens when the circle is broken. We see it all around us, right? So we're practicing in the sadhana, closing the circle and keeping the flow of blessings. Now, our teacher, Tara Tulku, went farther than that. He said that all of these things are, on the one hand, symbolic, but on the other hand, something else is going on. Because when you visualize making the offering is not just like somehow you pick up some flowers and you throw them toward the Buddha and call it good. It's not the way it works. The way it works is you imagine a goddess. You imagine a goddess coming out of your heart, holding the offering, and bringing it to the Buddha, offering it to the Buddha or the Bodhisattva or the Lama. And he said, when you do that, you imagine that the goddess is traveling on a ray of light. And that ray of light is actually energy. You actually, in visualizing the movement of a goddess making an offering on light, you imagine actual energy moving out of your body into the space, and you imagine actual energy of the blessing of the Buddha and Bodhisattva coming to you. You imagine an actual circle of energy that's being closed. In the tradition of Vajrayana, the key image is this, the Vajra, which is a circle of energy, unbroken. And if you look at the Vajra really closely, what you see, these little bumps here, are said to be the heads of Makaras, which means, technically translated, sea serpents. But the symbol is of the snake which eats its own tail, which is an old Western symbol also. It's the Ouroboros. Because the energy feeds on itself. That's the symbol of the snake eating its own tail. The energy feeds on itself, and as you cycle it, it becomes stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger over time. You break the circle, the energy peters out. You keep the circle closed and you keep the circle turning, and the energy becomes stronger and stronger. So this practice of reciprocity, of visualized giving, literal giving, offering incense, whatever you do, makes the relationship tangibly stronger. It cultivates the mind. It turns the negative minds of I'm isolated, my actions don't involve the world, into a wise, positive mind of everything I do impacts the world, for better or for worse. And I can choose to be wise about this. I can choose to understand my relationship with the world in a positive way. I can choose to impact the world in a positive way. And that's how some of these practices convert negative minds into positive minds, day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out.